Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives on the Youth Critic Network. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospectives. I am your host, Kale Smith. Joining me today is Brandon Cooley.
Hey, glad to be back.
Yes, it is so great to have you back, Brandon. Thank you so much for doing this. And Brandon, what movie are we talking about today?
We are talking about The Hunt for October.
The most brilliant commander in the Soviet Navy.
Ramey has trained most of their officer corps. He's nearly a legend in the submarine community.
The most deadly submarine ever built.
This thing could park a couple of hundred warheads off Washington. Nobody'd know a thing about it until it was all over.
Once more, we play our dangerous game with our old adversaries, the American Navy.
His plan is a mystery.
A man with your responsibilities reading about the end of the world.
Apparently, he has suffered a kind of nervous breakdown in which he announced his intention to fire his missiles on the United States.
Yes. So, for its 30th anniversary, we are going to be talking about The Hunt for Red October as part of the two-parter submarine retrospective, the other one being Crimson Tide. That episode will be out sooner rather than later, so keep an eye out for that one. But for this, for purposes of this podcast, we're talking about The Hunt for Red October. Brandon, what is your history with The Hunt for Red October?
Well, I saw they were playing on at AMC one day, and I texted you and Alex, like, yeah, let's go see Hunt for October. I forgot it was the 30th anniversary. I assumed they were playing it because since Sean Connery died recently, I figured they were picking
that too, but yeah. It's also been 30 years.
Yeah, it has been.
Yeah,
exactly. So I'm assuming it's those two reasons or one or the other. Yeah, I had seen it before and I loved it. I probably would say it was 5 or 6 years ago when I saw it. I don't know for sure. But I had forgotten enough of it to want to go see it again in the theaters. I remember really loving it. And it was better than I remembered it, actually. Great to see on the big screen for many reasons that we'll talk about. And you said you hadn't seen it before, right?
This is your first time. No, I haven't. I've been meaning to because I've always heard that was peak McTiernan. And it's been like peak. Like, everyone loves Die Hard. Like, that's the collective. Like, yes, Die Hard is great. Predator is also good. And then people kind of keep saying, like, it escalated and then peaked with Hunt for Red October. And then some people really like Medicine Man. There's a huge following for Last Action Hero, but I don't think that movie's as good as people think it is. And then it kind of went down after Die Hard with a vengeance.
Yeah, I've only seen four movies by him, if I remember correctly. That would be Die Hard, Hunt for October, Predator, and then Die Hard with a Vengeance. I actually have this page I pulled up on Wikipedia. I was looking at it before we started this, but yeah, those are all the four I've seen. Yeah, I feel like with his strongest are definitely Die Hard for October. We'll talk about this later, but Predator, we saw in theaters too, actually, a couple years ago.
Yes.
Pre-release. And I wasn't a big fan of that. I liked certain scenes in it, but I think what Predator was missing was John DeBonk, the cinematographer for Die Hard for October, and the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger is not as good as an actor as Bruce Willis and Sean Connery.
What?
I'm not an Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. I don't like Terminator.
I'm agreeing, but also I think also the problems with Predator is that it was still a story that was kind of being constructed as they were going along, and they had to redo a lot of it because they changed the Predator costume two-thirds of the way through filming.
Yeah, it's a great idea for a movie, and I like some of the creative idea, but yeah, we were watching it. It felt it had aged a bit. This Hunt for October did not feel aged at all. I felt like, no. I mean, besides the fact it was, there were some moments that felt aged, very brief moments, but for the most part, the cinematography and how it sounded, how it looked, felt like it could be a movie that, you know, was made 5-10 years ago, easily. Yeah, I mean, my favorite is definitely Die Hard by John McTiernan. It's a classic, you know. I watch every Christmas, usually. So hard to beat that. But yeah, Hunt for October is definitely a close second. I mean,
for me, I'm not to all, not to be, not to always agree with the consensus, but I think this is McTiernan's best. And the reason is, in Die Hard is an extremely, I mean, just close second. I think what gives the edge to me is Hunt for Red October just has like little moments, you know, throughout the film where it never loses its craft. Like, the only thing I can say that maybe is a negative to the movie is I'm not super big on Alec Baldwin's performance, but it's still good. It's just, I don't know if I buy what he's, I don't buy Baldwin completely as Jack Ryan, but that's beside the point. And also, but you know, it doesn't really matter because the script is just so finely tuned. And then there's no moment in Die Hard where it's, you know, where the twist, where you have that, the Armageddon moment, where the whole movie, you have everyone either speaking English or Russian to differentiate the two. And then it all comes together when one person says Armageddon. And not only is it like a great idea, but it's a great way to kind of marry the idea of the movie. And that is, you know, Sean Connery's people, they're on the same side as, they're trying to be on the same side as the US, and that is, you know, and you know in that scene what the goal is now, what the goal for every character's motivation is, what the story is going to be, and this is what's driving, and it allows the audience to be just kind of ride with the intensity and not try to think super hard about what the twist is going to be, and you just ride the roller coaster. Whereas Die Hard, you're always figuring out stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I would say that what I love about Hunt for October is it's a movie that's written for adults. And when I say for adults, what I mean by that is it's not 80s schlock, which the way I define 80s schlock, and I like some movies from the 80s that are like this, but
Commando.
How I defined it, I haven't seen Commando, but I'm aware of what it is. But how I define 80s schlock, though, is movies made by adults that where adults are acting like children, basically, where it's like, yeah, you kind of, it feels like it's for children, even though it's about something that could be for adults, you know. Hunt for October could have been that. It could have been really cheesy. I think Alec Baldwin's performance kind of like goes in that direction a few times, but it never really does. It's grounded in reality. I think that's what you meant, but like Alec Baldwin, I mean, he did a fine job, but everybody else though, besides him, it's a movie, it's a drama. It's not really an action movie. There's scenes of they include action, but it's all grounded in reality. This could actually happen, you know, circa 84, whenever it takes place. And that's refreshing, I think, at the time when it was made. A lot of movies like that, based on novels like Tom Clancy, I think, you know, they kind of just, some of those movies went kind of in ridiculous directions, you know.
The only other Jack Ryan thing I've seen is actually the Chris Pine one.
Mm-hmm.
I've not seen the Harrison Ford. I didn't see the one that Ben Affleck was in. And I've not seen the Amazon show. So
sure.
So my kind of relationship with the Jack Ryan series is I understand the character. Like, he's just an analyst. He's not like this big action, like, I'm going to, you know, get AK-47s to start shooting everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's an analyst. He's a smart person. He, you know, is an Army veteran who went through a nasty experience, you know, and that's why he moved, you know, careers. I get the Jack Ryan mythos, and I think it's a great entry point to a character, because that way, you know, you have a character that's human. Mm-hmm. He's not Schwarzenegger with huge muscles and invincible. He's a human being that's thrust in these very espionage-like situations.
Right. Yeah, I just think that, like, if you look at his movies, McTiernan's movies, you know, Predator, Die Hard, Hunt for October, they get more serious and more grounded in reality as they go along, you know? Mm-hmm. Not that Die, I mean, Die Hard's partly a comedy. There's comedic moments in it, but it's much more serious and grounded in reality than Predator, for example. You know, I mean, in terms of tone, nothing to do with the science
fiction. Well, when you have a character that's like, I don't have time to bleed.
Yeah.
That's totally realistic, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There you go, yeah. So yeah, I enjoyed that about it. And visually, I mean, it was great to see on the big screen. And I had forgotten about that, how visually well done it was. The close-ups, the use of how the camera moves, the use of color. Looks very similar to Die Hard, actually, in terms of the craft and how it was made. I'm not sure if you noticed that or not. But
well, the reds really stick out.
Really, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The reds in both, like John Nabot is really, you know, obsessed with the color red throughout McTiernan's movies. And I don't know if that was something they wanted to like marry with the two films together, but to me, but they do look very similar, but they also are distinctly different. Like it's a much like Hunt for Red October has a much more colder look. It has a much more colder, more cement look to it, not in a bad way. I know the Marvel movies get, you know, they get bashed for their cement gray, you know, aesthetic, but for Hunt for Red October, it works more because it's a war. It's a war, and we're in a submarine that's made, you know, made to look like concrete. It's made to look like basically a silver bullet.
Yeah.
So it works for that, you know, aesthetic.
Well, what's interesting about this era of movies, like 88 and 1990, where these two movies were released, is that that's when movies started to feel like they look like how they do now. In terms of, like, if you go before 1988 or 89, they start to feel aged in terms of the cinematography and editing. And after 1990, give or take, 89, 91, they start to feel kind of modern. And I don't know why that is exactly. I'm not sure if it's... it's like just technique at that point kind of cemented, like they but I feel like, you know, the 90s, you watch any movie in the 90s that was, well, what highly regarded, at least there's some bad movies in the 90s obviously, but any movie that was highly regarded, it's gonna feel like a movie made today. You know, I'm not sure if you've noticed that or not.
Well, I think, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, that's when the Editron or Editroids, like the first versions of like Final Cut.
Could be, okay.
Were starting to come in, and that's where you could have a much more linear editing system.
Okay.
So that's probably what it is.
Could be, yeah, that makes sense then. Because you just know something different. And that's not a bad thing by any means, because I love 70s movies where you can feel the editing is a bit aged. It's not a bad thing, but I just find it funny that like movies released in the early 90s do kind of feel like they could be released today, give or take a few details. But do you feel like this movie would be a blockbuster today if it was released? Not that I actually don't know if it was a blockbuster in 1990. Let me look that up. I think it was. I don't know if it was the top 10 or not, but do you think the pacing of it though would be accepted by audiences today? It's not a superhero movie. It's not like action packed. You think that'd be because it is slower. It does have a slow pace in the beginning. I mean, one great thing about older movies is that, you know, shots kind of linger sometimes. They don't always like, it's not as, I'm not sure if attention span's the right word, but, you know, the suspense is kind of drawn out sometimes in those movies like that.
Yeah. To answer your question, I don't know if it would be accepted like by younger generations unless they were film geeks.
Uh-huh.
I think this would play more to the Netflix, you know, adult crowd. Because right now you could do this. Here's the thing: you can do a movie like this for less than $50 million, give or take. I know the budget on this was $30 million, but that's $30 million in $1990. So, I think you can do this movie. Do I think younger audiences would accept it and be a big blockbuster? I don't know, because I think it's all about like how how much you hit the right nerves. Like, I think this could work for you and me and Alex and, you know, our friends, because we're very much, you know, in the know, and much more, you know, appreciative or much more enticed to want, you know, that adult kind of drama. But I think most people today would kind of see it as kind of a dad movie.
Yeah.
It has that dad.
It's kind of unfortunate. It is kind of unfortunate because, you know, I like a good submarine movie every now and then to have a break from the typical, you know, superhero or action movies that are
Well, those are palate cleansers.
What's that?
Those are palate cleansers. The adult, like, submarine movies.
Yeah.
Or just adult, like, dramas, you know, adult thrillers. Sure. Those make really good palate cleansers. That's why I think that's why more people are starting to like the John Wick movies. They're not as serious. Like, I get they're not as serious as The Hunt for Red October, but they're adult movies.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. I just meant, like, in terms of not just submarine movies, but a movie, a thriller that's slower paced, is what I mean. It's not a typical, like, beat 'em up or as great as John Wick is, you know, spy movie. It's an assassin movie, you know, Mission Impossible. The last one was fantastic, but like,
but the repeats of what
the repeats of what we've seen though. So I just, you know, in terms of movies that are like slower paced, you don't see that many nowadays. Unfortunate. Or in the box office, you see them, but not in the box office. Is what I mean. So.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Like, it all depends. I mean, you know, everything's still, it's not even necessarily about young people. It's more franchise based.
Yeah.
People really love their franchises, and we'll see. I mean, even the Mission Impossible, the Tom Cruise stuff that he's doing nowadays, like, they're all mostly IP stuff, except for, of course, American Made.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it's all somehow an IP thing. So I don't know. I mean, you're right on the Mission Impossibles. Those are actually adult dramas that are still, like, making bank.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I mean, PG-13, but yeah, they're meant to be taken seriously, not just depends on the franchise, but
right.
Yeah, this is a tight script though. I mean, yeah, not to go back to the movie. It's really good. You know, you really don't know at first if he's crazy or if he wants to defect. I like the ambiguity of that. I like the way they present the information about the submarine, and how they explain how submarine warfare works, because without explaining it, without showing it the right way, it could get kind of messy in terms of a movie, because it's underwater, it's dark, you know, you don't have any proximity to how close the submarines are. So to really make that work, you have to explain it. You have to really well. You have to have the music cues on the right. They're in the right way. You have to have the maps out. It's just interesting the way they did that, because yeah, that'd be hard to film a submarine movie, if you think about it, make it suspenseful.
Well, and also you have to remember a lot of the scenes where they are explaining, like, how they are able to track submarines, are able to find it through sonar or whatnot, and or even do the whole Morse code thing at the beginning, at the middle of the movie. It all develops each of the characters, even some of the minor characters like Courtney B. Vance's character, like, it all develops, and so you not only, you know, are getting the information about these ships and about how that warfare works and how they're going to fight each other, you understand, you know, a better level of each character that is at play. So, including even the minor ones, the people that are on the crew of Scott Glenn's ship, who apparently are the closest to the Sean Connery, the Red Hot October. So, it all works. Like, it's efficient screenwriting.
Yeah, I was going to mention Scott Glenn's character, because I'd forgotten this detail, but he's commands the Dallas, which is the American submarine that Alec Baldwin is on. And his character is written very well, because he's skeptical of this at first, but he slowly, you know, he wants Alec Baldwin to convince him. He's not like, he's just going to go along with his plan. That does sound kind of far-fetched at first. And it's very well written the way they handle it. But also one detail too with the way visually close-ups. I've often speculated that close-ups are the most important type of shot in movies, more important than medium shots or establishing shots, because it's kind of windows into the character's soul. In this movie, you're kind of forced to do close-ups in submarine movies because it's so tight. You know, there's not much space to really do anything else. And I think the close-ups are work perfectly with this. That's really what makes it so effective, especially with Sean Connery's character. The opening shot, I mean, that's literally an extreme close-up. And I mean, everybody really, I think that it shows you how if you can master the close-up, you've automatically kind of like, you're gonna get something out of your characters or out of your actors, so to speak. Challenging them to do better. So, you know.
Well, it's challenging them to come across their emotions and what those characters are feeling through this right here. You don't have the, you know, option to show it through body language. You have to use your face to give the subtlety and not overdo it or underdo it. So, yes. Yeah, I mean they are, and also inserts work because you can cut to some, you can cut from master or medium and whatnot, and you can intersplice it all together. So in there, you know, of course, and that works, and it also works very well in the other submarine movie, Crimson Tide. There's a lot of wide close up, long lens close ups, mm-hmm. and it's not even that the characters are just putting in the subtlety into those performances, but they're also like, you can just see the sweat that is coming off of them. That builds the intensity of the scene. So yeah, this is starting to feel more modern. These movies are, Hunt for October does start to feel more modern, but it's not, we're still in transition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Like John McTiernan is still kind of learning this whole, is still dipping his toe into this modern filmmaking.
Yeah, I guess what I mean by modern filmmaking, the 90s is when you really had the transition to that. But even 1990, the three movies that I can think of that, four technically, that were really popular. I mean, you know, this movie, Home Alone, Goodfellas, Dance with Wolves, they all feel very modern in terms of like compared to movies made in 1980, 1985, you know? Yeah, and you mentioned the editing process, the software, and that's probably one of the big reasons, but I think it's kind of interesting, but... so you had mentioned Crimson Tide. I hadn't seen, haven't seen that one. I still haven't finished Das Boot. I've seen a portion of that. I'd probably say that this and Das Boot are the two most famous submarine movies that I'm familiar with. But
not to spoil the Crimson Tide podcast, but I think that one movie kind of gets underrated a little bit, and you know, not as much, you know, and I think people should watch it and along with this. Like, I think this would make a great double feature. Because Red October is basically about two characters, the Sean Connery and Jack Ryan's character. They're all trying to get one goal. They're all trying to share this information of, like, you know, balancing out the war, because the conflict of Red October is the Russians have built the perfect submarine that can go stealth. Mm-hmm. And Sean Connery wants to give the Americans an opportunity to kind of level out the field, essentially, while also, you know, kind of getting free and, you know, getting, you know, a plea deal and all this stuff. So, and that's, you know, and then, you know, Crimson Tide is basically the conflict of Cold War, which is, you know, you're just seeing Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington, these two powerhouse actors, just, you know, basically fight over the decision to, you know, launch a missile or not. That's what that whole movie is. It's the difference between the two films that's fascinating, and but also Hunt for Red October is at least a little nicer movie, because at least everyone's trying desperately to meet up and get along. It's the conflict of,
except for Stellan Skarsgård, he just wants to, you know, he's the only
well, he's the one giving orders to find the ship and destroy it before the Americans do. So he's the Russians trying to beat the Americans to the, you know, to the finish line.
Yeah.
To the submarine finish line. But yeah. And then I have to talk about Basil Bondoris's score. The music. Yeah. It is so perfect with that, like, Russian opera, like, you know, that kind of goes around all around, that kind of floats around the movie, and it's used perfectly to, you know, build tension but also deflate it a little bit, much like in Die Hard when they're robbing, in Die Hard when they're like robbing the safe, mm-hmm. and classic music's playing. And yeah, it's Basil, and then it's used again to build tension. So yeah, I had to bring that up because I didn't get to bring up I don't get to bring up Basil Bondoris that much. He doesn't do a lot of big scores, yeah. if you think about it. But he's a great composer.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I thought of too, it's interesting, is that back then when the movie was made, you had a lot of best-selling authors who had their books adapted in movies. Tom Clancy, in this case, you had Michael Crichton with Jurassic Park, other movies. Stephen King always had a lot of movies, obviously. And you had The Firm by Grisham, I think is the guy. Yeah.
John Grisham.
Whole, and so
there's a whole John Grisham series through the 90s.
Exactly. Yeah. Same thing with Tom Clancy. Yeah. And so begs the question, is that era kind of over? You still have some Stephen King movies coming out. But besides him, though, that doesn't really happen as often as it used to. Do you think that best-selling authors, like movies based on that, are kind of dead, or is it just declining?
Yes, for movies, but I would also argue, I think they're moving more towards streaming now. Shows. Like Stephen King, I think, had a show this year called The Outsider, or a show based on something he wrote. And then, of course, last year he had It Chapter 2 and Doctor Strange, and I think Castle Rock was last year. And Pet Sematary.
Yeah. Well, Stephen King, each of his books have a unique identity to them. Like, there's something iconic about each one. Sometimes, sometimes not. But with Tom Clancy, Grisham, and Michael Crichton, they're a bit more repetitive, with like a few exceptions. This would be one of them, Hunt for October. But so I'm assuming that's why Stephen King movies are still being made, or books, movies based on his books. But in terms of like best-selling, like, I'm just wondering if like people, if best-selling novels just don't sell as much as they used to. That's why they don't, movies or producers don't invest that much money in them and in adapting them, you know? Because like we had Harry Potter, obviously, but now it's more about the young adult.
I think even that's kind of moved on.
And that's kind of moved on too, right? Yeah, like Hunger Games and Twilight's over, you know.
And Maze Runner, yeah.
That kind of died down, yeah. So I just think it's interesting that the book adaptations are not really what they used to be in the last 5 years, I've noticed.
It really hasn't. Like, the only holdout right now is Chaos Walking from Doug Liman, but I mean, that movie was filmed like 3 years ago, so.
Even Doug Liman, he directed the first Bourne movie. That was a book series. I actually read that book in high school. It's decent, but yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if this is because Americans are reading less than they used to, and that's why they don't really invest as much money in adapting them.
I think part of that, it's maybe part of that, but also
I think,
you know, Jack Ryan kind of, you know, when they did that show with Carlton Cuse and John Krasinski, of course, I think, you know, when that blew up and that got, you know, the same production value as something like Hunt for October or even other Jack Ryan adaptations, I think people were like, well, we don't have to make movies like the Jack Reachers anymore. We don't have to do that anymore and then just hope for the best, you know, hope, For at least $100 million gross. We don't have to do that anymore. We can just put it on streaming and get those fans, those adult fans that we already have, you know, for Netflix or Amazon or whatever. We can just get them to watch our, you know, 8-episode show every year, and that be the end of it.
And it makes more sense for books to be adapted into TV series or on Netflix, streaming, whatever, because technically a book is easier to adapt into an 8-episode or 10-episode series rather than a 2-hour movie.
And you can expand on that material.
Exactly. You're not condensing as much. So that does make sense.
Because that's what I think. I think the Jack Ryans, you know, and I know they're doing a Jack Reacher show on Amazon. They did make another Tom Clancy. They did adapt Tom Clancy's Without Remorse with Michael B. Jordan in the lead. And I think, but now because of COVID, it got moved to, it's going to be released via Amazon in the next few months. I don't know exactly when the date is. But I know that for a fact that everything that's kind of a more adult, more, you know, but, you know, what we could do on a $50 to $60 million budget, we're just going to do it for TV. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to get, you know, we're going to get the best, like, second stunt directors or second unit directors we can find, and we're going to direct the episodes while hiring TV showrunners like Lost creator Carlton Cuse, or other, you know, Emmy winning writers to basically bring their sensibilities and adapt these, you know, these novels and these characters to the, you know, to our format.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, we might not be seeing more Jack Ryan movies, but there's a Jack Ryan show you can watch on Amazon.
Yeah. Just something I thought of, but
And I think that, and I want to believe I heard at some point that they're, that the Hunt for Red October storyline is going to get implemented in the John Krasinski show. I might be wrong. But I've heard certain things. I don't know if that was ever official or not.
I was actually, it's funny you mentioned John Krasinski, so I was watching a marathon of The Office today while doing stuff, just on randomly on the TV. Whatever channel it was, but I always think of John Krasinski as Jim Halpert, and it's hard for me to imagine him in other roles. The only reason Quiet Place works for me because he didn't speak at all. I felt like whenever John Krasinski speaks, I just hear Jim. It takes me out of the movie, and that's not his fault or anything. But yeah, I haven't seen Jack Reacher, the show, but I'd be interested to see how he does a different character like that, who's so different than Jim Halpert, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know. I think Krasinski is a good actor. He is, for sure.
Yeah.
I have not seen, of course, the Jack Ryan show, but, you know, I think Krasinski is a good actor, and his Quiet Place movie was really good, and I have not seen Krasinski in that much more.
I haven't seen him much. I think it's a sitcom thing. When there's sitcom actors who are great, even no matter how great they are, you just see them as that character. Like in Friends, for example, I think they all six could have done great work, and some of them have, but they're kind of typecast as their respective characters. You know, you just can't really imagine them in other roles. You know, it's interesting, but yeah.
Well, I think for them, I think they, like Jennifer Aniston obviously had a great career. Courtney Cox had a really good career.
The one I was thinking of wasn't even the two of them. It was David Schwimmer in the O.J. Simpson miniseries. We're going down tangent, but yeah, it's just something I've noticed with like sitcom actors. They have a hard time transitioning. They get typecast, but
yeah. But as far as Hunt for October goes, I really do like Sean Connery's character here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really great performance, and it's more incredible to hear that John Milius wrote a lot of his speeches. For those who don't know, John Milius is basically the guy, if you've ever heard a great speech from like the 70s, 80s, and some of the 90s, John Milius probably wrote that speech. He's a great, like, just dialogue writer. He's a guy who basically wrote the USS Indianapolis speech in Jaws, which is, I mean, the greatest scene in all of film history, and you should watch it if you haven't seen it already.
Greatest scene? Okay. It's good. Yeah.
It's pretty damn good.
I'm not a, not to go down another tangent, but I'm not a biggest, I guess I'm not a fan of Jaws as much as other people. I really like it, but yeah, I like that scene. Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting.
It's a great monologue there.
It is, yeah, it is.
Well, it's a great monologue scene. But yeah, John Milius is the guy. He directed, of course, the Conan movie, which I actually don't like. I don't really like his Conan for some reason.
Conan the Barbarian?
Yeah, I don't really like his Conan the Barbarian movie.
Never seen it. Yeah. Well, Sean Connery, this is my favorite movie by him, and I haven't seen really that many, but I didn't like him in Untouchable, actually. That's, people pointed that as his best movie that they won the Oscar for. And I actually despise the Untouchables overall, not just him movie. But this is definitely his best one, though. I mean, do you have a favorite performance by Connery? Like, I mean, the last Crusade is pretty good. It's a good performance for what it is.
I mean, this is, for me, his greatest, but also, I have not, admittedly, I'm a terrible James Bond fan. I have not seen any of the Connery Bond movies. Me neither.
I have no interest in seeing him. Yeah.
I think his performance in Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie is actually pretty good.
Okay.
Even if it is kind of creepy and, you know, swarmy, but I think that's for a purpose. The one I would say is underrated is his King Arthur turn in First Knight. I get that Richard Gere is totally miscast in that movie because he's the only character in that movie that doesn't have an English accent. I get it, but what Sean Connery does with his King Arthur as an elder King Arthur who's trying to find love and then is betrayed but still has to be the top, like the king, and keep his composure through all of it. I think it is a really good performance. It's not his best, but I think he gives, you know, but he brings a lot of pathos to his King Arthur that, you know, is surprising in a very 90s-esque love story from the guy who made Ghost. It's really good. I've also not seen the Highlander movies. My Sean Connery is actually kind of full of blanks. I actually have not even seen The Untouchables.
Dude, I would be so fascinated to hear your opinion on The Untouchables. That's a movie that not to go down tangent again, but yeah, I was shocked at how bad that was, and that people love it apparently. And I think I have a theory for why, but yeah, it's interesting because that's the one he won the Oscar for, and I haven't seen James Bond, but I mean, I think he was an actor who had great potential. This is the only movie that really like used that, you know. I mean, Last Crusade was good. I mean, that was definitely a good performance. Well, I'm looking at his list up here. I haven't seen too many movies in, actually, admittedly.
Well, I think
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, that's one I've seen.
Mm-hmm,
forgettable. Yeah.
Well, I think part of Connery's problem was always that he was always going to have to in the shadow of Bond.
Yeah, I guess.
And which, I mean, he's really good at it. I haven't seen the movies, but I've seen clips of, I mean, I've seen obviously like the highlight reel of it, of his movies.
I have too. I have trouble taking it seriously, so I've never really wanted to watch.
I don't think it's meant to be taken seriously.
And then I wonder what the point of it is then, because I just grew up watching Daniel Craig as James Bond. Like, to me, he is the quintessential James Bond. Besides, I have no interest in James Bond movies outside of Daniel Craig, so I don't really. But yeah, I guess that's probably true. He's always. James Bond's always been like the
it's always kind of been a male fantasy. Like, it's always been so, and I think you have to kind of approach each Bond like that at first, and then you come for those, and then you stay for like what's actually going on in each Bond movie. Sure. And that's why the Daniel Craig stuff works a lot better than some of the other films.
Yeah, well, the Daniel Craig ones are just kind of much more serious. I mean, that's obvious, but yeah, a whole different tone. But yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at his list here. Yeah, I haven't seen too many more.
Yeah.
Oh, Murder on the Orient Express. I've seen that. That's a really good movie. I don't remember his performance though in that. Interesting.
I still haven't seen Sidney Lumet's version. I've only seen I've seen the Kenneth Branagh one.
Oh, the new one? Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen the new one.
Yeah.
The original one's pretty good.
Yeah, I need to watch it because apparently a lot of people love Hercule Poirot, and a lot of people like Sidney Lumet's version of it.
Mm-hmm. It was good.
I haven't seen it. Even though I really do like Kenneth Branagh's, I kind of like Kenneth Branagh's take on the character, even if he does pronounce it as a cute butthole. Which is like, wait, what? Why? It's a cure parole. But yeah, whatever. Yeah, so is there much more to say on Hunt for Red October?
Not that I can think of, yeah. I just saw it playing with some theater, so I figured I'd ask you guys if you wanted to go see it. And yeah, it was a great theater going experience. Maybe because I haven't seen movies in theaters for months, you know, it may have been one that
almost a year. Enjoyed
it so much. It's almost been a year. Yeah, it's the last movie we saw would have been January, so it would have been. How many months was that? 10 months, give or take.
About 9 or 10. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's why I enjoyed it so much. But yeah, great to see it in the theater.
Yeah, I will say this. It's great to watch The Hunt for Red October because you get absorbed in the whole drama of it all, and you get absorbed in the tension. And also, like, it's a fun movie. Like, Hunt for Red October is a fun movie. And you know, I mean, it's not like a laugh a minute movie, but it's still like a great action thriller. And when you think it's all over, you know, when the Americans come into the submarine and they're greeted and they're standing, it doesn't end, it doesn't end right there. It continues on. There's a huge action scene, and it's really good. It's really good, and there's a great sense of humor throughout the film when the president of the United States Secretary of State guy who comes up to Jack Ryan and says, I gotta be a politician who will, you know, kiss babies but also steal candy from babies. So I like that bit, and I like that his character, all the scenes with the Russian diplomat who's just like, look, we lost a submarine. We need your help to find it.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's like, we lost another submarine. You lost another submarine.
One last thing, too. It was interesting to see a movie where Tim Curry played a character that was normal. Not like a comedic role or crazy or kind of flamboyant, wild. It was just a very normal role for a movie like that he was in. It's just been interesting because I forgot he was even in it. But yeah, big cast, a lot of people. Who are famous now or famous at the time too as well, but like Sam Neill was before Jurassic Park. It was pre-Jurassic Park for Sam Neill and before The Piano, you know, so it was like probably one of his first big movies, I'm assuming, but I don't know much about his career.
And this was a big movie for Alec Baldwin. I mean, he never really, he kind of always got stuck as like the comedic actor, which is odd because he is a serious actor, but then he just became Donald Trump for us.
Yeah, sure. Well, his big breakthrough, I think, was, let's see, Glengarry Glen Ross was a big move for him in terms of his being able to really chew that dialogue. But yeah, he was in stuff in the 80s, though, I know for sure. I don't
Beetlejuice.
That's right, Beetlejuice, yeah. Don't know much about his career. But anyway, yeah. A lot of good actors.
Yeah, great actors, good script, great director who's fresh off of their most successful movie. And yeah, so I did not see Medicine Man, and you haven't seen Last Action Hero, correct?
Nope. I'm not.
So, I think the problem McTiernan had throughout the 90s is that it's hard to tell because I've only seen, you know, Last Action Hero and Die Hard. And Die Hard with a Vengeance, I'll go for. It's a good movie. It's a good movie. And then Last
Action Hero. I prefer Die Hard 2 over Die Hard with a Vengeance. Am I the only one who prefers that?
Die Hard 2 is not bad. It's just.
I actually think Die Hard 2 is fantastic. I didn't know people hated it as much until so when I watch my Die Hard marathon, I usually always watch the first two. And then the third one, I kind of skip everything. I didn't know people actually prefer the third one over the second one. Just a small thing.
There. I like two. I think four is fine.
Four is good. Yeah, four is good. It's five. It's really bad, right?
Yeah, that's five. The one. That's the one. Good Day to Die Hard is rough.
Yeah, four is good. Four is decent. Yeah.
We should have all seen it coming because it was I feel like we should have seen it coming. I don't know what necessarily happened. I think the problem is a lot of McTiernan's productions, even like Die Hard and Predator, all had like production problems. And I think for Medicine Man, like his follow ups, they all just continued to have production problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then it finally ran into muck with The 13th Warrior, which was like at the time the most expensive movie, or one of the most expensive movies at the time, because they had to do so many reshoots, and then they had to get Michael Crichton to come in and help direct some of the reshoots.
I'm looking at it right now on Wikipedia. Yeah, Eaters of the Dead, I've heard of that book that you wrote. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I am familiar with the Thomas Crown Affair. I haven't seen it. I've heard a lot about that. I didn't see any of his moves after Die Hard with a Vengeance, it looks like. But yeah, well, I mean, he's in prison, it sounds like. I mean, he went to prison for a while. At a certain point, I mean, maybe he just personal issues. He couldn't make any more movies that were good. I don't know. It's hard to say.
It is. Before that, he made Rollerball, which I think that pretty much put him in director's jail.
Yeah.
or was about to put him in director's jail. So, yeah. Was it even something that was bad?
Oh, he went to prison for?
Yeah.
I can't say for sure. I'm reading about right now, and I don't know much about it. I don't want to say anything that's not accurate, but felony conviction, incarcerated. Yeah, it's has to do with wiretap. I don't know. Worth looking at later, I guess.
All right, we'll come. All right, oh my goodness, wow. Okay, yeah, maybe you shouldn't have wiretapped some other people, Mr. McTiernan. Anyway, I really like this movie. It's probably my favorite. I should probably watch it a few more times. I've seen Die Hard so many times that I probably should give this one a few more chances. But right now I'm kind of like Red October. I feel like it's like the best, like he has the best DP working for him. One of the best composers, great script, great actors, great. Like everything just came together for this one.
Yeah, I mean, Die Hard, there's a magic to it that I just love. And so I don't think that, it's not really worth comparing the two in that regard. Because, Die Hard is something I watch every Christmas almost, or every other Christmas. So it's not, different kind of movies. But, definitely a close second, though, for me. Mm-hmm. Sure. One of the best movies of that year, I would say. I think it probably should have gotten a Best Picture nomination. compared to, ironically, the movie we're going to go see soon is Godfather 3. That was nominated for Best Picture, and this wasn't. Just kind of odd.
And I think, and it was from the same studio.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, Paramount did both Red October and Godfather 3, so.
Interesting.
Oh, well, I hate to be the one that messed that up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so is there any final thoughts on Red October?
I think I can think of. Yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie. It's a great movie. I highly recommend it. It's now out on 4K. So if you have a chance, go check it out. There's Paramount released a steelbook for it. Go check it out. It's available to watch anywhere. It was in theaters, and now I think by the time this episode comes out, it'll definitely not be in theaters anymore. So, Brandon, thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you have anything to plug or anything to mention that you're
not doing? Movie related? Not really. I don't really use Twitter that much.
All right. Well, if that's the case, thank you, Brandon, for coming on, and thank you so much. And we will. And you can find me on Twitter at Movie Kale. We'll be back next week to obviously talk about Crimson Tide. Thanks, everyone.
Might be trying to defect.
You're just an analyst. Why can you possibly know what goes on in this mine?
I'll give you 3 days to prove your theory correct.
I am not field personnel. I am only an analyst.
You're perfect.
I'm expendable.
He's defecting.
You willing to bet your life on that?
From the best-selling novel by Tom Clancy. From the director of Die Hard.
Give this man a chance.
My orders are specific.
Battle stations.
Sean Connery. Alec Baldwin, James Earl Jones, Scott Glenn, Sam Neill. The Hunt for Red October.